Back Talk is an extension of the award-winning movie review show It's Movie Time, which airs on Thursdays at 4:01 and 8:01 p.m. on WCBE 90.5 FM. Produced and hosted by John DeSando, this podcast features additional content and banter with guests. Back Talk is listed by FeedSpot as one of the top 10 movie review podcasts on NPR.
So sweet. I'm John DeSando.
And I'm KG Klein.
And this is Back Talk. Tell me about an animation because you are my man for that. It's Movie Time and Cinema Classics. You are the go-to guy.
I love animation. I love all forms of animation. And boy, do we have a winner here. A movie called Flow. And you might not be familiar with this. This is not a Disney movie. This movie is coming out of Latvia, a very small country. And it is Latvia's entry into the Academy Award for Best Foreign Film. And it is one of the best films of the year, let me tell you.
Oh, no, I have to agree. And you and I talked, before we get into it, I guess you and I talked about whether it could be my favorite anime.
Yeah. Inside Out 2 certainly is a front runner, along with Wild Robot as another one.
Yeah, that's right, too, yeah.
But this movie is so unique. It is so different. If you think that this is just another cute animal movie like Lion King, oh, you could not be more wrong.
Would you say it has some familiarity with the House of Ghibli, with Miyazaki?
No, I wouldn't even put it in with Miyazaki. Well, let's stay.
The animation is
very stylized. Yeah. It was done using an open format free app that cost them nothing, and it was done on a very small budget. This movie cost $4 million, and it's one of the best movies of the year. And Disney can easily spend $120, $130 million making a movie like Wish, or even more making Mufasa. But for 4% of what Disney spent on Wish, we get Flow. And Flow is a movie that will stay with you for the rest of your life.
All right, give us this just a brief.
Okay, the story is very simple. Five animals who have been caught in a disaster. Their world has been turned upside down by floodwater. We don't really know where they are. They might be in Thailand. They might be in Laos. They might be Cambodia. But they're in the span of a couple minutes, we watch their luxurious lifestyle, their life of leisure, get turned upside down by a catastrophe that affects all of them. And they manage to get to a small sailboat, one at a time. We pick them up along the way. And then they have to kind of learn to live together. The narrative of this story is not the main point of this story. This movie is less like a movie, and it's more like a song. It's like a song like Strawberry Fields Forever or Purple Haze that doesn't have a story. It's left to the imagination of the viewer what is really being told.
Well, allegorically, it's difficult to discern. The cooperativeness of this is something that we're all going to value in the next 4 years.
You can tell that the director...
Survive.
Absolutely. And various film critics have tried to speculate what this movie is really about. I think that's a disservice, and I think we'll get into that a little bit more in the podcast, but this movie is deliberately trying to be like a Rorschach test, where they're showing you a visual image, and they're leaving it to you and to your life experiences to interpret what they're showing you and decide for yourself what you think it means. Well, and that is so refreshing today.
We've always contended we're not trying to ram down themes or morals in the movies that we watch. We look at them artistically, and then when we find some a really powerful motif such as this, we're happy for it, right? We don't demand that everybody be able to interpret it the minute they get out of the film, because it is an experience that's both visual and emotional, as good animators do. They just have the love of lovable.
It is such a departure from the movies that we're seeing these days, where directors feel that they need to convey every single plot point clearly and perfectly, and they give you tons of exposition to make sure that they've rammed down your throat exactly what this movie is trying to tell you. This movie does not do this, and this is why it's so refreshing. This movie is allowing you to interpret it. It's allowing you to find yourself in this. And the two movies that I want to compare this movie to, Apocalypse Now, Coppola's classic.
Boy, man, is that a weird... That's good. I want to hear you on that.
Well, Apocalypse Now, as you recall, is mostly a story about this group of people going down a river in a jungle patrol boat, a river patrol boat during the Vietnam War, and how they interact to each other versus the conflict around them. And they have to learn to bond or not bond as their world degenerates before their eyes. I mean, Apocalypse Now, at the end of the day, was an allegory about the history of of Vietnam.
Sure.
But the other film that this story that this reminds me of is The Diary of Anne Frank.
Okay.
The greatness of The Diary of Anne Frank is not that it's so much that it's a Holocaust story, because you don't really see the Holocaust taking place. You know what's going on outside the walls. But what The Diary of Anne Frank is about is a group of eight people who have to come together and survive together, even though they have very diverse personalities. They're forced to come together as a group and survive for the duration of the story.
Ken, so people are going to ask, so how about the dialogue?
There is no dialogue.
So that this to me is an indication.
Yeah, this is not The Lion King. This is not Watership Down, where the animals talk.
Right.
All the sounds in this movie are the actual recordings of the real animal sounds of these animals,
right,
with the exception of the capybara. They substituted a babe camel because a capybara didn't sound very good.
Right.
But the rest, the cats are real cat sounds. The secretary bird is real secretary bird sounds. And let's talk a little bit about our cast here.
Well, before you get to that, I'd just like to say this is not anthropomorphic. This is not human-centered.
It's
best. They don't have characteristics of humans. I mean, they do in a sense. But basically, they're animals.
It is some of the best animal animation I've ever seen. They have the animal specific species behavior down perfectly. It's magical to watch how well they are able to represent the different species exactly as they act and behave. So our cast is a small black cat, and this is the character that we see the movie through. Then there's a kind of lethargic capybara, a very materialistic ring-tailed lemur. There's a very playful golden retriever.
Yeah, the golden retriever.
And then finally, there's a very proud secretary bird. Each one is a very different personality, and it's very true to the original animals. They're not departing from the animals, but they're also in that personality instilling the animal as an allegory.
Yeah.
You can see that the capybara might be somebody in a disaster who is lazy and lethargic, but manages to find some way to survive.
Well, yeah, you know, and for the you cat lovers out there, you're going to recognize all of the signals that the cat gives without speaking.
The cat is scared.
The cat can arch its back.
Yeah.
Beautiful big eyes.
The cat's pleading eyes and its desperate cries are some of the best performance in any movie this year. It really is. And the secretary bird becomes sort of the leader of the group by de facto. But you can read into these animals that the director was trying to represent with these animals very specific, not just people, but very specific groups of people. And it's dangerous to try to interpret too much before that, but you could, depending on your point of view, you could see the secretary bird as perhaps the military or a soldier,
a
group that has found a way to survive easily in this catastrophe because they have the resources to do so.
And you use the word. This is a survivalist movie.
Yeah.
And you can put yourself in that very situation. But what's so very nice here is that there aren't any humans.
There are no humans. We see human dwellings.
Yeah.
The cats living in an abandoned house. We see what looks like ancient Southeast Asian temples as we're sailing through
the
water.
And what about the statues of cats?
Cats that the cat's owner presumably was making. But there's another character in this movie we haven't gotten to yet, and that character is the water itself.
Yeah.
The water becomes a character in the film. The water both devastates the landscape, is deadly, but at the same time, it supports them.
Yes.
It's the thing that keeps them moving. It's the thing that provides food for them. So the water is a neutral character. The water is neither hateful nor is it friendly. It is merely there.
Although it's pretty ominous coming through that forest.
Oh, yes.
From the point of view of the cat.
It's ominous and it's terrifying.
And I'll tell you, Ken, one of the things that I liked about this movie as well is that I was perplexed at the whale.
Oh, the whale, yes.
Right, until I saw the end.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was brief. Man, they just don't give you too much.
Okay, we'll jump in on that. Yeah, this is a movie that you do want to stay through the credits because there's a big Easter egg at the very end of the credits that is very important. I'll just point out real quick, this is not a movie to take a six-year-old to. You're not taking a kid to see Lion King with this movie.
No.
There's a lot of peril in this film that's very intense, and it's going to be too much
for
a small kid.
Right.
I'd say 13 and over, you're probably safe.
Oh, Ken, but you're way too tough on
younger
this.
Than 13, I think you're going to be dealing with
seven
some...
or eight.
Really?
They
I would disagree.
Because it's such an emotional movie. I think they can catch it without having to go so deep.
I think you're going to scare kids. I really think you're going to scare kids with the peril and the tragedy.
Ken, so you already have answered my question. What do you advise?
Oh, I strongly advise you to see this movie. I'm hoping that this movie is going to get noticed by the Academy Awards. It should. It's already the best-selling movie ever to come out of Latvia.
Very good. It's called Flow, F-L-O-W. You were talking of kids, you said, or something?
Yeah, so this, I don't think this is a good movie for anyone under the age of about 13, just because there's some very, very intense moments of peril where these animals are in jeopardy. You don't know if the animal's going to live or die. At one point, you think the cat has died. And so I think for kids who've grown up on movies like The Land Before Time or The Lion King, this is going to scare them. This is a lot more intense than what kids are used to. But once you get over about the age of 13, I think this is fine.
All right, we got the attention of a lot of our cat-loving audience. These people are usually smarter than the regular people, so I suspect our large...
That's no insult to our dog-loving people
But we know cats are so demanding. They're so demanding because they don't care.
Mm-hmm.
How about cat movies? Now, I'm going to throw this right out immediately. Felix the Cat?
Yeah.
All right, so qualifies, right, as a cat?
Are we talking only animated movies, or are we talking live-action films?
Yes, both. The most famous ones, the ones we can identify immediately. And then there is that flop of movies called Cats.
Cats was the flop motion picture version of the Andrew Lloyd Webber stage play, which is now ranked up there as among the cult movies that people go to late at night and heckle, Rocky Horror Picture Show or The Room.
I enjoyed the live production of that.
Oh, the live version? They should have just put a camera on the stage and filmed the production. It would have been better.
And then I was looking at some others, and I thought, and you know most of these.
Well, all kinds of cats we would be doing with Lion King, of course, and Mufasa coming out probably by the time you hear this. And then we go back, and we've got a lot of magical movies dealing with cats, Bell Book and Candle, going back
a little ways. Very good one. I've got that on there.
The Harry Potter, of course, Mrs. McGonagall. What does she become? A cat.
And how about a Blofeld's cat in From Russia with Love?
Blofeld's cat, which we see in most of Blofeld featured Bond films.
Right. Godfather.
Oh, yeah.
And do you know that they picked up that cat as a stray just outside and he gave it to Brando?
I'll be darned.
And what an effective.
Oh, yeah, it works beautifully.
That's typical Brando. Yeah. He can do anything. But isn't that strange? They had not planned on it.
Not planned on it,
no,
and there it was, yeah.
Then we have Milo and Otis, and that would be similar to our movie in the sense that you got Paling.
Yeah.
We have animals doing that. Pet Sematary.
Yeah, probably Stephen King's scariest book. It's the only one that Stephen said frightened him.
Here's a really tough one from 1979.
What's that?
Alien.
Oh, yes. You've got the cat, Jonesy. Jonesy the cat. And Jonesy shows up again in Aliens, too.
Oh, and maybe my most romantically favorite cat. And this would have to be from Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah.
Cat.
Okay, yeah, cat. Yeah, cat from Breakfast and Tiffany's.
Because I think of her and I think of that whole movie, which I love very much. What a great, I guess if I had a cat, I might call it Cat.
Cat.
And
it said a lot about her as a person that she couldn't name the cat because it would become too familiar to her. It would become something that she couldn't part with. And she, lived a life where everything was disposable.
Yeah.
One of the things I want to talk a little bit about Flow.
I know I sidetracked you. With
I love talking about cat movies. I could go on and on and on. I can go back a ways further. Now, this movie has been reviewed by most of the major film critics. It's not been ignored. Flow. But it's interesting to me. I see this as a movie where what you bring yourself into the theater, your personal life experiences, are going to influence the way that you interpret this film. Because there's no real strong narrative. That what you take from this film is what you put into it. Other critics, though, have tried to pin down exactly what the allegory is about.
Mm-hmm.
And I find this fascinating because, for instance, the Roger Ebert site film critic is a young fellow. He was discovered in a high school contest for film critic contest for high schooler kids. But with Flo, I think he's 22 years old, and he tries to pin this down as a commentary on climate change. And since we're on the podcast, I'm warning you guys with some spoilers coming here. But he tries to pin down what each of the characters represents, and he believes that the Secretary Bird represents liberal politicians who saw climate change coming and tried to warn everybody, but then when they got themselves safe, and because they knew this was coming, they're very indifferent to those who they left behind, except for this one Secretary Bird in the movie that is empathic and very sensitive and tries to help. He sees, and I found this fascinating, he sees the pack of dogs as representative of conservative capitalists who are exploiting the environment without regard for the long-term future of mankind. They think only of themselves. When the disaster comes, they manage to grab the best boat, but then 45 minutes later, we see that they've trashed that boat, and now they're stranded on a temple. And the secretary bird doesn't want to help them, doesn't want to rescue them, but the rest of the group, including the cat, decides to go and save them. And as soon as they get on this boat, they immediately devour all the resources. They start trying to steal all the property. And then later on, when they're called upon, when everybody's needed to help save two members of the boat, they're the first ones that run away. Interesting commentary, but I don't know if I agree with that. And I also don't know if I agree with the idea that film critics should be trying to pin this movie down and say, this is what this story is about.
Well, if they use the right language, it could be. I'm thinking that maybe it is, if you make it vague enough, because these filmmaker, and I'd like to mention his name, Gintz Zilbalotis.
I hope to heck he gets an Academy Award.
Now, when you don't give names to your animals, when you give no background other than the flood, when you make things vague, then I think you're asking for exactly what you just did, or what Ebert's website just did, which is interpreting. And for most films, I love doing that, but I've tried to be very careful, like letting people know this is just the way I'm looking at it.
And that's the point. I think as critics, we're called upon to say to our audiences, this is a movie that you need to interpret. But I think it's a disservice for us to say, this is what this movie is about.
This is what the Ebert guy does, he tries to pin this movie down
and say, this is what this story is about. This is the secret behind the allegory. And don't do that. Leave it up to each audience member to pull from the movie what their life experiences have led them to see. And that makes it's like if you listen to Purple Rain or Purple Haze, or you listen to Strawberry Fields Forever, don't let some critic tell you what that song is about. Find that song yourself.
How about Puff the Magic Dragon?
Well, yes.
Although, to me, come
that
on.
That one, we
I
all have a pretty
I
good
think
idea
almost on
what
point.
That song. And it's interesting, too, that I wasn't able to think of a song that's come out in the last 10 years that is vague enough like Strawberry Fields.
Largely because you can't hear.
Well, that's part of it. And also, I think songwriters today really want to try to convey the meaning of their songs.
Yeah.
And the art of doing something like Purple Haze or Strawberry Fields or Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds seems to have gone by the wayside. And that's a pity, because I think there's a great talent in writing songs or making movies that leave it up to the audience to decide what are they seeing.
Another thing to add to what you're saying, and which leaves it open, something I really like about this film, it's open. It's open for you, for what you mentioned it, what you bring to the film, is the animation itself. There's no attempt to be photorealistic here, and I find that
intriguing. Thank heavens.
Yes, right. Yeah. Which, of course, you know, Toy Story, et cetera, you're sharp as hell for it.
Well, and that's CGI animation. Yeah, and we're going to see the pinnacle of that with Mufasa, which will be coming out right about now, where they tried to make this photorealistic. And Disney is trying to go this route. They're trying to make photorealistic animation.
I think
animation.
That's a mistake.
I do, too. I do, too.
It's a whole different genre. This is a whole way of telling a story.
When I go back and I see Jungle Book or I see Fantasia, there's an art. Animation was an art, not a photograph. Yep. You can film a movie. You don't need to make it with CGI. But there is a art to animation that is being lost when we try to do this photorealistic.
Well, look at my first example, Felix the Cat.
Felix the Cat,
there's nothing
yeah.
realistic about
no,
that.
No, heavens no.
And it invites magic.
And when you see movies like, if you remember, Bakshi's Wizards, where the animation is so stylized that you realize you're looking at an artist, not a computer.
Yeah, right, exactly. All right, K.G. Kline, I don't know whether we've invited families to see Flo or not.
Leave the young kids at home.
You and I will talk when we talk about our nominations for the Oscars and so on. I'm thinking that not enough people will have seen Flo.
I think Flo will probably take Best Animated Film.
You are such an optimist.
Well, but remember, last year with very strong contenders from Disney, the award went to The Boy and the Heron from Miyazaki, which I would argue is not maybe deserving
it's
of that.
It's cute, though. It's
a cute one, but it's not one of Miyazaki's best. And I think right now there's, just as we just had this discussion, I think there's an anti-Disney push among the animation departments of and animators, who are one, the ones who are going to be doing the voting on this. And I think that's where Flow has a very good chance, because it is so different, it takes so many chances, and it is so effective.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be seen by a lot of people as long as it's seen by the voters.
Look, is it incomprehensible? No, it is comprehensible. There's a flood.
There's
and they're
flood.
The only ones apparently who are left,
and
are these animals.
And there's a very specific style to the storytelling. If you remember, you see throughout the movie the characters are obsessed with reflections. They're seen when the cat looks into the pool of water and sees the reflection of himself.
It's really one of the first images.
One of the first images.
Yeah.
The lemur is self-obsessed with its image. But do you remember what the very last image is before the credits? The four of them looking together into the pool of water. And what that means is they become a community.
Great.
They're no longer just themselves. They're now a community.
Yeah. It's Flow. Ken, do you have any final words on Flow?
It's going to be hard to find. Most places it's playing only around noon or 1 o'clock, so you might have to find a day when you have time around the middle of the day to see it.
Yeah.
Find it and see it, especially if you're an animation fan or you're an animal fan. See this movie and expect it to be emotional.
Yeah.
Maybe bring a little bit of Kleenex with you.
If you want something totally different, then go see this.
Yeah.
Because they're going to be Mufasa's all over the place. They're going to have all this animation. But you want something really
Movies
odd,
like this are so rare.
Yeah. And take a date, even.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't have to be for 13-year-olds. It could be for 23-year-olds.
Absolutely.
And
I mean, you and I, you know, we're no spring chickens, but we enjoy this movie.
We did.